While under. 41. Hitchhiking into Key West, the blimp over Cudjo called Fat Albert, keeping one eye on Cuba, the other on Cartagena, Dickie Dickerdick had been inside it. Monty's Fish Market, Mangrove Mamas, the antique biplane at the Sugarloaf Lodge. Cars parked down by the mangroves on Big Coppet, mostly fishermen, the occasional masturbator. The military dead zone, just after Rockland Key, where the naval station sits. My nose fried to a crisp. Cubans fishing along the pedestrian paths, 5, 10 rods lined up in a row. The pink of the red snapper drowning in a dry bucket. Free beer tomorrow, painted on the face of the Stock Island bar. Mercedes and her husband Paul, they owned the eatery. Sweeping the sand from the flagstones for $3.35 an hour just before the morning rush, returning South Beach to itself as the beachcombers slowly stirred. Pausing to watch the waves hit the breaker, you could see all the way to Cuba on a clear day. Running down Duval for Café Con Leches, one for Paul, one for Hazel, one for Billy Ray. Mercedes demonstrating how to properly scour a cobbler dish after it comes off the buffet. The line cook saying to me, "Do you know what jailbait is, boy?" Fruit smoothies, fried plantains, conch chowder, all exotic to the kid who grew up going to state fairs and corn festivals. The crackhead, a former publisher of the Key West Citizen, whose morning ritual began at the eatery and whose hand shook lifting the coffee cup to his lips. The Poles, Cubans, Bahamians, and hippies who showed up at South Beach around 10 and did not leave it again until cocktail hour. Don't be confused by, quote, South Beach, a small clutch of sand on Lower Duval next to the Atlantic Shores Motel and a crumbling pier, worlds away from its Miami counterpart. Cracking eggs for the next morning's buffet into 5-gallon buckets with Mohawk Dave, the breakfast cook. He later died of an overdose. Bussing tables with Blind Richard. He died in a boating accident. Hazel smoothing out her dollar tips at the end of a shift. She died of ovarian cancer. Receiving the week's deliveries, boxes of produce, sacks of potatoes, and carrying each item into the walk-in or dry storage. Learning from Charlie, different Charlie, hockey player from Ottawa, how to thicken a gravy using cornstarch. He was stabbed to death in Bahama Village. Watching O'Neill clear the mounds of seaweed from South Beach with his backhoe. He died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Sharing a rum and coke, my first, with Snake, in his empty one-bedroom on Flagler. Hard to say what happened to that guy. The three Polish brothers, not a word of English between them, manning the kitchen for Paul at night, as hard-working as they were mute and pale. The dough hooks spinning in the Hobart, mesmerizing. A stink that attached to me after a shift, a dumpster stink and grease coating. Miss Caltran asking how things were at home. She disappeared off Big Pine in 89. Principal Menendez with his million-dollar smile and gold herringbone chain. The Spanish instructor Hernandez made to roam from classroom to classroom with a wheeled cart full of props and slides. Our mascot, the hammerhead shark, a full-size gray one outside the main entrance, made of welded metal, the least waterborne thing on earth. Doing my homework at the McDonald's on Roosevelt or in the bright stands at Bayview Park. Sleeping rough, on occasion, between stilts or on Smathers Beach. The names of bars painted directly on the stucco facades, doorless doorways leading into the adult darkness. Captain Tony's, the Hog's Breath, the Full Moon Saloon. Feeding quarters into video games in the open-air arcade on Duval. Getting propositioned, offered booze, weed, $10 to suck a dick. Coconut trees and banana leaves. weaving dinner plates and top hats out of palm leaves, as the Jamaicans taught me to do, selling one to a tourist in a Cubs cap, putting him securely in the past as I head Danville, Charlie Prophet, the House on Vermilion. Why? Recoiling from the unremitting press in Key West of adult content, sex toys in the windows, phalluses marching in the Fantasy Fest parade. Yet also going through puberty, sneaking peeks down tourists' shirts. They hated wearing bras on the island, on their honeymoons. Crashing on Ella's couch. She had a son who was killed in Vietnam, until her roommate, the eatery line cook who queried me about jailbait, woke me with his heart on. AIDS everywhere, in the ranks of the waitstaff, hospitality workers, conch train conductors, moped repairmen, the tourists themselves. Watching Billy Ray die of AIDS. Watching Billy Ray, the queen of wit, who weighed all of 100 pounds, put his lips on the spout of the orange juice dispenser and blow giant bubbles into the thick liquid to disperse the accumulated pulp, then opening the spout to watch the juice flow freely again before returning it to the buffet and its, quote, thirsty bitches. Watching hundreds of the unsuspecting from Kansas and New Jersey fill their little juice glasses. Mallory Square and the man who walked on broken glass, the man who walked across hot coals, the capsized boat with the garbage bag tarps at the end of Houseboat Row, gone now with the video stores and the salt ponds. Sneaking into Sloppy Joe's to take a leak in the middle of chaos, on the edge of losing it. Being called to the principal's office, believing I'd been caught, this would all finally end, they would send me north, or put me away. But being told instead that I had won a countywide writing contest and would be treated to a canoe trip through the salt ponds with Jimmy Buffett, a musician of some kind. Meeting Jimmy Buffett. Jimmy had a puppy. He ordered us a pizza. He had hired a Jamaican to do all the paddling. The moped I bought for $75 from Hazel's fat boyfriend, a man with zinc on his nose. Trying to throttle, brake, and steer one-handed, difficult to do with so low a center of gravity. But needing to get from South Beach up Flagler, over to Roosevelt, into Whitehead Bight, to sluice the boats returning from their charters for $2 lousy bucks a pop. Leaving Cudjo for the last time. Looking for trouble. Starting to find it. Smoking cigarettes. Shoplifting. Learning from Mohawk Dave how to cook and inhale. Thinking I didn't need Charlie. Thinking I didn't need anyone. Being detained outside the Eckerd drugstore with a greeting card down my pants. A greeting card. While in my wallet there was over $100 in cash. The arresting officer saying, "Well, son, is there anyone you can call?" It is hard to know now why I did not turn to him long before I was detained. I suppose Marcy was not the only one in whose ear Charlie Prophet poured her poison. I suppose that I, too, knew all about crass, disappointing Charlie Barnes. Besides, who was I? A nobody. And he was in Chicago now, in a whole new life. Did he even remember me? But would it be worth a shot, I wondered, now that I was in custody? I didn't dare reach out to him before that. I didn't dare give him the option to decline. I didn't dare, and I didn't dare. Until one day I did. We were reunited the year I turned 15. It was a brief and magical time. He couldn't believe that, as happened with Jerry in 1975, he'd assumed, once again, that all was right with the world because a boy was with his mother. He had no idea I was living on the street, sleeping on the beach, hanging out with drunks and the half-dead, while Charlie Prophet and Dickie Dicker Dick pursued their divorce. And I spared him 90% of it. He took me in, no questions asked, and we agreed to put the rest behind us. My stepmother welcomed me with open arms. Evangeline was childless and happy to keep house. A native of Romeoville and the eldest of three daughters, she took great care to put her face on daily before an illuminated makeup mirror. She loved dried flowers and sachets of potpourri. She drove a Chrysler LeBaron and owned a blue-eyed Siberian husky named Stevie Nicks. All this was a far cry from Duval Street. She encouraged me to watch television with her in the living room, which she had nicely decorated with doilies and throw pillows. Evangeline's idea of heaven on earth was to curl up on the sofa with a lap blanket and a wine cooler and a new episode of Knots Landing, which was just fine by me. I don't recall now what she did for a living, but it had nothing to do with historic narcotics or child abuse. It was a leave-it-at-work kind of job, and she left it, happy to come home to me and our soap operas. We lived in Downers Grove, in a little cottage on Benton Avenue. She made us sloppy joes for dinner, bought me CDs from the Sam Goody and fruit roll-ups from the Jewel Osco. Downtown Downers had a discount theater called the Tivoli, with a neon marquee out front. There, in 1989, for $3 a piece, the whole family, saw the strangest double feature in the history of Hollywood, Weekend at Bernie's, followed by Do the Right Thing. The old man was in heaven, went back for a refill of his tub of buttered popcorn. He had gained weight and gotten older, but he was still so much like a teenager himself. We played a lot of ping pong in the basement and joined a pool league at a place called Muddler's on Clybourne. It was at Muddler's, where I learned to shoot one-handed with a bridge, that Charlie first told me about juniors in Danville and his father's time running a hustle for a steak horse in Little Egypt. His father died later that year in Danville. I remember the funeral. I remember the tears streaming down my Uncle Rudy's face. I had been under the impression that no one cared for Alden Barnes, a deadbeat and a loner. But there was Rudy, shaken to the core, and Charlie right beside him. You can't lose a father and not be affected in some profound and unexpected way. I considered myself the luckiest person on earth to be in the care of Charlie Barnes. An alternative fate was all too easy to imagine, landing in some central Florida penitentiary, or learning to suck cock for $10 a shot, or using the wrong needle on a whim. Instead, I was learning trigonometry at Downers Grove North, picking my zits and drooling through study hall. I had been rescued. I had to repeat the 10th grade, but at least I was alive. And this beautiful spell lasted 3 full years, until Charlie began his affair with the nurse at First Baptist. Evangeline and I were in the basement one night watching Knots Landing when the phone rang. He said to offer her some excuse and to meet him at the McDonald's near the highway. When I pulled up beside him 20 minutes later, he rolled down the window and smiled under a beige Kangol cap. Still a year from starting his own outfit and leaving Bear Stearns forever, he was driving a high-end Lexus leased for a small fortune. We exchanged a few words. Then we rolled up our windows and I followed him into the night. The geography of Chicagoland confounded me. We entered the highway and past toll booths and clover leafs, corkscrewing irreparably into townships unknown. Our final leg consisted of a series of intensely local turns that left me bewildered. That Charlie did know where we were, that he went there by feel, that he pulled up before a second home, lesser in every way to the first, as if he belonged there, paid the bills there, parked in its driveway to announce the end of a night, astonished me, and that we approached the front door and went through it unimpeded and without knocking astonished me further still. the loyal stepson of another woman, I was being initiated into the house on Rust Road. Was it fair of the old man? Was it right? He was too punch drunk to think straight. To some extent, the discomfort I felt at his betrayal of sweet domestic Evangeline was tempered by the flattering fact that he had not forgotten me. His new romance was incomplete or unreal until I, Jake Barnes, had stood witness to it. Once I set foot inside, once I beheld his new amour, he could say that he had united his two families, his past with his future, his delight with his duty. Nothing feels more natural or morally sound as having all your family under one roof. "Come on in," Charlie said to me before crying out. "Honey, we're home!" "Honey, home?" There was chaos everywhere in this new home of his. Library books climbing the staircase, unfolded laundry on the couch, dog toys littering the carpet, at least two competing televisions with volumes on high. He would eventually impose order on 105 Rust Road, but he didn't technically live there just yet and made no claim on its conditions. He still flickered uncertainly between a knight in shining armor and one more jerk who would come and go, and no one, not even he, could say for certain which way it would ultimately break. A dog skittered, its nails clacking as it rounded the bend and came at me. "Yort!" cried Charlie. "Jake, meet Yort." "Yort? Get down, Yort!" "What kind of name is..." Yort, a comically protracted, dachshund Doberman mix, had pounced. His nails were like a spiked mace, and he used my legs as scratching posts. "Yort is harmless," my dad said, "but a pain in the ass. Just brush him off you like this." He demonstrated. Yort repounced, and a pattern was established, together with a new circle of hell. The pouncing persisted, it seemed, all night long, until my veins had been opened. But it was the act of brushing Yort off that stayed most vivid in my mind. He was free to take liberties with the pets. "Shoes on or off?" I asked him. "Whatever you prefer, son. I want you to feel at home here." "But is there a custom?" "Better take them off," he whispered. I knew much more in that moment than shoes on or off. I knew there were customs, indeed, and that they were whispered. More information came fast and furious. Barbara had a son, a future private in the United States Army. He materialized out of nowhere, 6 years old at the time, and charged me like a bull.
"Charlie's here! Charlie's here!"
this little guy sang out, naked but for a pair of camo undies. He stopped on a dime in front of me.
"Saddam Hussein!"
he cried, and with that, hauled off and whaled me in the nuts. I doubled over. He screamed away like a banshee. My father clapped after him in fury.
"Troy!" he cried. "Troy, come back here this instant and apologize."
"Sorry about that, Jake," he said.
"He's a work in progress. Here, let me take your coat."
So disorienting for me were those first few minutes, from our free and easy entry to our pulling out chairs for ourselves at the kitchen table, as if we had been dining there as a family for years, that I imagined it had to be a skipped reel of some kind, a waking dream, a hallucination. Where were we? And why would we swap the cottage in Downers Grove for this low-rent study in mayhem? Perhaps he's lost his mind, I thought, and the real man of that house, alarmed by our voices, will soon rush downstairs, locked and loaded, and force the two wandering maniacs out the door. But no one came threatening. And as the night wore on, I noticed all the many quotidian ways Charlie's presence had been woven into the domestic tapestry all around us. His hats on the coat rack, his shoes on the welcome mat, his newspaper on the arm of the recliner, On the kitchen table, mail with his name on it. In the fridge, his favorite brand of beer.
What the hell?
I whispered.
What? Where are we?
Jake, he said. I can't hide it anymore, son. I'm in love.
But what about Evangeline?
Not unlike the sharp-taloned Yort, my father pounced.
Shh!
What? I said.
Not that name. Not here.
Evangeline?
It's tearing me up what I'm doing to her.
He was whispering again.
But I haven't felt this alive since I fell in love with...
He lowered his voice still further.
Charlie Prophet.
It must be said that, at the start of the affair anyway, the house on Rust Road delighted him. It was where his new beloved lived, and he never wanted to leave. Well, okay, I thought. I was open to change and always happy to meet new people. But the longer I sat there, the worse I began to feel, as if I were the one cheating on Evangeline. She had taken me in no less than he had, and I was not exactly gung-ho about starting all over here, in another house, adjusting mentally to the new accommodations, sleeping in whatever bed I was given, sharing breakfast with strangers, all that, but still expected to express gratitude, feign harmony, perform that old trick called family feeling. I was goddamn sick of starting over, and had no appetite for a new crew, when that delivering angel, Evangeline, was waiting for us with soap operas and snacks back in benign and orderly Downers Grove. I loved the old man and appreciated his enfolding me in this new charade, but he'd gone and ruined a good thing, and briefly I understood the complaint made so often against him. He was selfish and short-sighted. Jerry thought so. Marcy did too. All his ex-wives. This was it. My first experience of the old man following his worst instincts. It made me mad. Evangeline, I said.
Shh, Jake!
Evangeline!
This is not the time or place.
Are we just erasing her from the record?
Absolutely not, no. Only right now.
Right now, she's sitting at home watching TV, waiting for you to walk through the door.
I know, I feel terrible.
We heard footsteps on the stairs. Evangeline, I said.
Please don't, Jake.
Evangeline!
Stop it, Jake. That's it. No more. Evangeline!
I whispered, more fiercely than before. That name remained on the tip of my tongue for years inside the house on Rust Road. Evangeline. The bearer of that name was a revenant capable of unleashing total ruin, of reminding them of the ruin they had unleashed. And I had the power to conjure her. I had the power to conjure them all. Sue Starter, Barbara LaFirst, Charlie Prophet. To trace the breadcrumbs of history back to earlier cottages, more legitimate queens. I was serving not as a witness to a new romance, but as an accomplice to a broken vow, to a whole slew of broken vows, and when Barbara and I finally locked eyes, shook hands, said hello, we knew this as he did not. I was the institutional memory in a house of forgetting, and for that reason alone, Barbara would never accept me. Curvy in scrubs, her hair cut short, Barbara was no local beauty a la Charlie Prophet. But at 34, she was something of a honeypot for a man getting up there in age, he was over 50 by then, who had never thrilled to Evangeline's bony frame. After she shook my hand, all her calculated mirth dropped off her face as in a mudslide and failed to return for the remainder of the evening.
"Does he want a Dr. Pepper?"
she asked, rubbing her nose without looking at me. They were the first words I heard her speak, and they were directed at my father.
"Would you like a Dr. Pepper, Jake?"
Chuck asked me. "Sure, I'll take a Dr. Pepper."
"We only have diet," she said. "Is he okay with diet?" Diet okay, Jake? Diet's fine, I said. Can he open it? He can open a can, honey. He can even work a can opener, can't you, Jake? I can work a lawnmower. That's true, he said to Barbara. He mows my lawn. I hate mowing the lawn. I don't mind it, I said. I could mow your lawn, I offered. Chicken for dinner, she said. Does he like chicken? Great, my dad said. Jake loves the bird. My father got me a Diet Dr. Pepper, and the two of us retreated to the living room. After a while, he thought he should ask Barbara if she needed help with dinner, and when he left for the kitchen, I was free to look around. Crocheted scenes of God and country hung in oval frames, affixed to the wood paneling. There were a dozen VHS tapes and one dictionary, vaguely chewed on an otherwise empty bookcase. Something else, too. I stood for a closer look. A blackened banana peel. I returned to the sofa. I later found half a hot dog lodged between two of its cushions. This, I thought darkly, was precisely what Dickie Dicker Dick had been trying to avoid whenever he kicked Marcy and me off his bachelor furniture. I watched Troy, the future soldier, watch TV, which he did by gripping its side paneling and engaging with it as if it were sentient. 10 minutes later, his sister, Tori, 14, large and dark, appeared in that room fully naked. She was not yet accustomed to Charlie being there, let alone Charlie's children, and had no reason on earth to guess at my presence in that room. She was on her way to the basement to find some fresh clothes after a shower. She got one look at me, gasped, cupped her private parts, and reversed in horror out of the room. Yort, who had been chasing his tail for 10 minutes, was now whining at the sliding glass door. A clever devil, he combed his elongated dog's body across the dangling Venetian blinds to attract my attention. Then he turned with clacking nails and stared at me as the rattling noise from the blinds slowly died. "What do you want, boy?" I asked him. Or should I say girl? Just what the fuck is a yort, anyway? Yort wagged his tail. I got up to see if I should let the dog out, but when I entered the kitchen, my father was gone. So was his new lady friend. They had retreated upstairs. I went back to the living room, resolved to finish my diet soda and ignore the dog completely. But a half hour later, I too had to pee, and my sympathies went out to the mutt, who was still whining and doing his trick with the blinds. I stood and opened the sliding glass door. Bursting, and beaming, too, I still believe to this day, beaming right at me like a freed prisoner, Yort, an indoor dog, went straight through the hedgerows and was never seen again. Shortly after I returned to the couch, but well before everyone went out to search for the dog in the rain, live music made me start. I turned in alarm. An ancient old lady with a raspy voice was playing her heart out on the piano in the corner. I hadn't registered its presence until that moment. And when exactly had the human being materialized? She played a show tune to start, followed by an old standard. The little soldier swiveled his head without unhanding his television.
"Grandma!" he cried. "Turn that down!"
Grandma went on playing without a care. My father returned from his time upstairs with Barbara. I gestured at the old lady. "Oh, right," he said. "Barbara's mother, very musical." I revealed the hot dog between the sofa cushions. "Where's Yort?" he asked. That desperately fleeing dog was a blessing in disguise for poor Barbara, who had reason to resent me without ever having to hear the name Evangeline. We didn't eat that night until 10. 42. By 7 in the morning, some 15 years later, Barbara and I remained a pair, of sorts, sitting together in the waiting room of Rush Memorial. Her son was in Afghanistan. Her dog was still missing. Her musical mother was dead. Her husband was then undergoing a massive medical procedure. I read books during that time, did puzzles to distract myself, fielded a call about an appearance on Conan. At some point, I looked over at her. Though inscrutable as ever, she had stuck by his side and was solely responsible for questioning his test results and possibly saving his life. I recalled what Charlie had said to me the night before. Barbara and I do not delve. Well, Barbara and I did not delve either. In fact, what we did could hardly be called chatting. I preferred Evangeline, as Jerry preferred Sue Starter and Marcy preferred Charlie Prophet. But Evangeline had remarried and moved to Newport Richey, Florida. It might be past time, I thought, now that the old man was undergoing life-saving surgery, to ask what he saw in Barbara Ledoux. Who was she, and what made her special? I was just about to inquire when she looked up from her magazine. "Just so we are clear," she said. It was a rare instance of eye contact, very unsettling. She usually kept me in the periphery and preferred me in the third person.
"Should anything happen to him moving forward, there will be no more talk about you-know-who."
"Who's that?"
"I think you know."
"I don't think I do." Then it dawned on me, Evangeline. If he were to die, she did not want any mention of the wife that preceded her at his memorial service, in his obituary, in any remembrance whatsoever.
"The three of you?"
"Who?"
"You and your siblings," she said.
"There are four of us," I said.
"You tease him. You treat it like it's all just a big joke." "Well, it's not a joke to me, and I don't find it funny."
"No one thinks of Evangeline as a joke," I said. She looked directly at me again, twice in one day.
"I'm not talking about Evangeline."
"Who are you talking about?"
"The one you call by my own name. His second wife."
"Barbara LaFirst?"
"There is no such person as Barbara LaFirst," she declared, "and you damn well know it."
"Beg your pardon?"
"There is no other Barbara. That is a fiction."
As in the cartoon in which the cat, primed for resentment, pulls from some hidden pocket a long sharp pin in the presence of a balloon that in the next frame transforms into the revolving blue world, casting a shadow of doubt across the cat's brow even as the pin brightens, I was presented with a fiendish choice. Drop it or destroy the world.
"You've made her up to taunt me, the three of you."
"There are four of us," I said.
"You knew it would play on my vulnerabilities."
"As far as anyone knows, Barbara, you have no vulnerabilities." That put an end to that. His second wife, a fiction. Had he failed to mention her? Had he selectively omitted, conveniently edited out the original Barbara in conversation with the new one? He might have wanted to spare them both a little embarrassment, make his past a bit more palatable. Five is a large figure where wives are concerned. I wouldn't have put it past him. What's more, I wasn't sure I could blame him. We all need our little white lies. I would leave it to Jerry to stand on the street corner, stomping his rod of iron and crying, "Truth! Truth!" "Okay," I said. "There was no Barbara LaFirst. I made her up. We all did. A little inside joke at the old man's expense. We didn't mean any harm by it. I don't believe that for a second. But you won't hear me say another word about it for as long as I live." There was a long pause.
"Thank you," she said.
She would have done us all in, I think. Not just his second wife, the very real Barbara LaFirst, and the other wife she had been whitewashing for years, sweet Evangeline, but his first and third wives, too, and the children he bore, their pets and addresses and childhood interests. The afternoons in the park, the opening nights at Red Mask, the endearments, the snapshots, the road trips, the potlucks. Everything that predated her and diminished the dream. All we had to defend against this was memory. It was a sunset memory of bountiful, heartfelt Danville, Illinois, as much as it was of any one man. It was a memory of the house on Vermilion, the bunk beds, the foster kids, the man outside mowing the lawn. It was a memory of his headbands and wristbands and the hookshots he took on afternoons at the Y, and a memory of his Chrysler Newport, an old beater that Barbara never knew, but I did. What pleasure there was seeing him pull in again on another Saturday when he had kept his promise. Later, in transit, I would watch the road going by from within those shamrocks of rust and the floorboards at our feet. It was a memory of Kickapoo State Park and its picnic tables and our card games and of how, in one of those sweet surfeits of time, we sat around comparing the size of our hands. Finally, it was a memory of a rented motel room on New Year's Eve, an occasion he made special by buying a bottle of cider champagne and putting it on ice in the bathroom sink. We had every intention of popping the cork at the stroke of midnight, only we got caught up in a TV movie instead, a John Voight vehicle called The Champ, in which a father and son stick together through good times and bad, only to be separated by death in the end. Believe it or not, extensive academic study has determined in some scientific way that The Champ is the saddest movie ever made, provoking more tears from the unsuspecting than either Bambi or Terms of Endearment. It's not a tear-jerker so much as a finely honed torture device. Well, we hardly needed the Academy to confirm for us our feelings. "You're gonna die," I cried, clinging to him. And the only way he knew to redeem that holiday was to pop the cork early on our ice-cold cider. I was a lifetime removed from those memories, and presently hostage to a dull mauve waiting room that drained the human soul of its magnificent contents and replaced them with 7 generic watercolors and 6 rows of chairs. If you believe, as I do, in the mind's need to be out from under anxiety to approach even the borders of the past, to say nothing of its campfires and lakesides and sudden stunning views, inside that drab and sanitized room, I should have shut down completely. I was under duress. A dear man's life was on the line, and my companion was Barbara. It was all the more surprising, then, that another, still more elemental memory came to me unbidden. I was in the bathtub. Steady Boy was at the mirror shaving. Charlie Prophet had been coming and going for 10 minutes, swooping down on a used towel, pausing to comb her bob, climbing into a pair of slacks, popping back in to retrieve her hot tea. A red hair dryer, dangling down the wall by its tangled cord, came to rest an inch off the floor. Elsewhere, hand towels, tube socks, bikini underwear, softball jerseys, and 100 other stiff and limp things from life in mid-action hung from mismatching hooks and bars. The tub was lined with traction strips and was gritty from an old scouring agent. Just over the ledge sat a pink bath mat, permanently branded by the tapering half of a hot iron. When I hung my arm over, issuing military instructions to those action figures holding down a remote base camp there, I soaked the floor, that rug, eventually their fresh socks. Presently, however, he was still shaving at the mirror, when that foster parent extraordinaire, Charlie Prophet of Peoria, Illinois, reappeared, in her morning hurry, the frantic general to his ever-patient sapper, to issue another round of instructions. Out! School in 20 minutes, and I still had to eat breakfast. I objected, conscientiously, if not outright. Getting dressed, going to school? What were those things compared to the war of good and evil being waged in every corner of that tub? My Luke Skywalker, missing his left arm, which I tore from its socket with my teeth, was being swallowed up by the blind snout of the faucet. My G.I. Joe was done, swept up inside a lunar volcano, while green plastic soldiers paraded in formation across the slick ledge. Snoopy dangled over the lip in the hopes of being rescued by the Man of Steel. This ragtag team of playthings was all a jumble. I knew nothing of timelines or toy lines or the dictates of corporate branding. That's right, back then I loved a blended family. These good and bad guys, supplemented by a silver bowl, a chipped mug, a plastic flute, and a powerfully squirting bottle of Pantene, as essential to bath time as the water itself, defied gravity, violated the laws of physics, and skirted death at my whim. Was that whimsy, that magic, at a time when Charlie was in such peril, the cause of the return of that particular memory? Whatever the reason, there was simply no denying it. Before the nurse at First Baptist, before Dickie Dicker Dick in the Florida Keys, there was Charlie and Charlie of Danville, Illinois. The one was a caseworker at Old Poor Farm, the other an insurance salesman. They had a dog named Thumper. They had a boy named Jake. We had picnics at Kickapoo State Park and went to church on Sundays. And just before she left the bathroom for good that morning, before he put on a fine suit and tie and disappeared down the drive on his way to the office, and before divorce blew our little family to smithereens, Charlie put her finger to her lips to let me know we were conspiring, then reached out and pinched his butt. She goosed him, and always game, he jumped, he hooted, he shimmied, he marched up and down like a toy soldier. I had one task that day at the hospital, and as time wound down, I began to fixate on it. I had promised him that I would find his dentures and return them to his mouth when the operation was over. I got fidgety around 5, 10 full hours after the operation began. By 7, when there was still no sign of the surgical team, I began to pace. "What is taking so long?" I asked. Finally, the nurse appeared. Surely that meant he was out at last and we would be taken straight to him. But I didn't have the damn things yet, and tried to stall.
"If both of you will please just go back to your seats," the nurse said. "Someone will be out to give you an update shortly."
"May I speak to you in private?"
"What for?"
Barbara asked. I turned to her. "I would like a word with the nurse, that's all."
"Are you looking for these?" she asked.
From her purse, she pulled the blue container in which he kept his dental plates.
She had them? But how?
She rattled them in the air as I fell silent.
"Oh, don't be a fool," she said,
and took up her seat again, as the nurse had requested.
She knew, of course,
and loved him all the same.